I mean, who would have thought that, you know, writing incidents from school would bring a chap to you saying, write a book and I'll pay you to write the book. I mean, most writers, you know, peddle their work around and look for publishers and look for agents and find disappointments. And, you know, here's somebody coming to me saying, write a book, for God's sake. And I want to be a writer. So I started, and that's, and that got picked up. I'm not religious or superstitious in any way, right? I absolutely believe in rationality and science and so forth. And it comes from, I don't know where it comes from, I think it comes from a revolt in childhood against the superstition, which accounted for the poverty that I saw all around me. You know, I saw a lot of foolishness. You know, people lacerating themselves for religion, people believing, including my own family, believing all sorts of nonsense. And when you see the kind of poverty that I grew up looking around, that was, it convinced me that there was a connection between irrationality, superstition, even religion, and that degradation of humanity.
That was writer, author, and political activist Farooq Dondi on episode 14 of the Bobby Jagdev podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. I am in complete awe of my guests today on the podcast. But before I go into framing today's conversation, I have my usual request. If you could kindly rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts, then I would really appreciate it. And also, don't forget to sign up to my mailing list. If you sign up to my mailing list, you get detailed show notes and notifications of new episodes once they're released. It's a great way to share these conversations with your friends. Now, today's conversation. I really am in awe of my guest today. An iconic writer, author, and political activist, and a friend to literary figures that have influenced civil rights movements and also world leaders such as Barack Obama. He is an integral spoke in a wheel of influence and an icon in the civil rights movement in the UK, Farooq Dondi. Now, Farooq's achievements are self-evident. He has this diverse body of work that spans decades and a rich set of acquaintances of which he shares so many stories in this conversation today. Acquaintances and friends that he holds so dear. Now, in today's conversation, we navigate Farooq Dondi's history. After graduating in natural sciences at Cambridge, he was presented with this moral dilemma. Natural sciences, physics, would have resulted in him contributing to India's atomic weapons program. However, this wasn't aligned to the developing political inclinations that Farooq was starting to adopt. So, Farooq course-corrected and found direction in writing. This change in his trajectory of his career came at an interesting inflection point in the history of the UK civil rights movement. Farooq was well positioned, well educated, and ready to nurture a craft that could help balance the scales of social injustice. His timing, like everything in his life, had him at the right place, at the right time, with the right skills, and around the right people. Farooq reported on the trial of the Mangrove Nine. The Mangrove Nine defendants were on trial for incitement to riot. This was around several incidents that had occurred around the Mangrove restaurant in, at the time, a predominantly West Indian neighbourhood of Notting Hill in London. The Mangrove was a home to writers, activists, authors, musicians, people like Jimi Hendrix, Nina Simone, Bob Marley frequented the Mangrove. So naturally, with so many dominant, influential black voices in and around the Mangrove, it became a target for the establishment. The trial was a watershed moment in the history of the UK civil rights movement. It defined institutional police racism. Farouk, alongside the Mangrove Nine defendants, went on to form the UK Black Panther movement. Yes, Farouk was one of the founding members. Farouk is often engaged in consultations for major TV and film productions such as Gorilla by John Ridley and the recently aired BBC series Small Axe by Steve McQueen. And that's how me and Farouk connected. I reached out to Farouk after watching Small Axe and we scheduled and teed up this conversation. Now, both of those productions, amongst many others, have Farouk's fingerprints all over them. Stories, historical insight, and characters that are integral to those productions were all sourced from Farouk's own experience as a founder member of the Black Panthers. Now, that movement would introduce Farouk to some incredible, formidable, and influential characters that have shaped civil rights in the UK. Darkus Howe, C.L.R. James, Barbara Bees, Althea Jones, and even the Nobel laureate, V.S. Naipaul. Via his activism and writing, he'd eventually diverge into the realm of theatre and TV. The Black Theatre Cooperative was a gateway into numerous creative roles as editor and writer for Channel 4, the BBC, and numerous independent productions, whilst at the same time he was crafting an immense body of literary work. Now, this conversation navigates Farouk's career via a collection of stories based around friendship. He shares intimate conversations with his house guest, C.L.R. James. How C.L.R. even came to live with Farouk is an interesting story within itself. And he also shares some of the conversations that he had with C.L.R. James, such as his encounter with Trotsky. He also shares memories of his friendship with Darkus Howe and the influence of Althea Jones and Marla Sen, who was his first wife and also the author of the book that became the film, The Bandit Queen. If that wasn't enough to entice you, we also explore how a turbulent set of encounters with the Nobel laureate V.S. Naipaul turned into a lifelong and close personal friendship, and how Farouk was the only reporter in the room when the Beatles met the Maharishi in 1967. Amazing. Truly amazing. Oh, and actually, at some point, we also hang around with Pink Floyd during this conversation too. Now, for me, there was also a personal interest story in this conversation. Because my grandfather migrated to the UK from Punjab in India in 1952. And, you know, I never paid attention to his stories about fermenting racism and how he adjusted and integrated into life in the UK. From what I remember, he was also very vocal about the labour movement that was so pivotal in shaping immigrant rights. I didn't have the insight or the inclination when he was alive to ask questions or even listen. And now I wish I had. So for me, this conversation with Farouk was an opportunity to start to fill those gaps. My dialogue with Farouk took place on New Year's Eve of 2020. And this was my opportunity to start to appreciate the political atmosphere at the time, to understand the actors who were the architects that shaped the life of privilege that I get to live today. And after this conversation and reflecting on my own family's history, I start to appreciate that debt of gratitude that I hold towards the activists and socialists that rose against systemic oppression. This is a conversation about social justice, friendship, nurturing relationships, and being present in the moment. And upon reflecting on my conversation with Farouk, I later realized that he doesn't care much for legacy. And, you know, we're often consumed in strategizing to create a legacy as opposed to being present in what we do. But Farouk reminds us that we just simply get on with life, embrace moments, and be present in those moments, support those around us, and give our time and attention to others. I was in complete adoration of Farouk's achievements, a man of incredible accomplishments, sharing amazing experiences and stories. Farouk made me reflect on my own relationships and the purposefulness of my own body of work. I do this to improve myself, to learn, to widen my lens and hope somewhere a message or a conversation will have some sort of social or personal impact on a individual. And to me, that is Farouk Dondi. Truly an honor and a privilege to have spent time with a legend. A moment in my life that I will honestly, truly treasure, and a newfound friendship that I hope to nurture. Before I invite you to join this conversation with Farouk, it comes with a parental advisory. This episode contains explicit language, and I wasn't going to even attempt to temper Farouk's forms of expression. So if you have young, impressionable ears around you, for which you'd be horrified if they repeated some of these words or asked you what they meant, then I suggest you isolate the sound to your ears only. So with a great deal of gratitude and privilege, I am so excited to share this with you. I invite you to join my conversation with Farouk Dondi. Farouk, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
It's a real honor to not just have this conversation with yourself, Farouk, but also on New Year's Eve, on what has been probably one of the most unusual years. But what I'm, I think, interested in is you have, in a respectful way, many more years behind you than myself, and probably experienced many other unusual years.
Nothing quite like this, Bobby. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never been in a plague year. I have been in particular situations where one had to stay at home or do something, you know, in, mm-hmm. For instance, floods in Bombay. They piled up through the afternoon, evening, and then the evening you couldn't get out because all the cars were floating in the floods and so forth. So I've had to stay at home for, say, 1 week or 2 weeks and, you know, try and get food together and see how much rice there is in the cupboard and see whether there are any potatoes or anything going, you know. So I have been in that sort of situation, but never like this in the plague year, the isolation and all these regulations and so forth. But I have been, I mean, I walk out every day and don't go into shops, you know, order it from the supermarkets. Mm-hmm. And done a lot of writing, done a lot of cooking. It's been all right.
Well, I guess in Mumbai, just those small periods of isolation, I guess it's a shorter period of time, isn't it, than the length of isolation that I think we've all been experiencing.
Yeah, absolutely. Shorter period of time. And then there were, you know, there are no emergencies, but living in Kanpur, in the Indo-Gangetic Plain in summer, you can't go out after, say, 9 o'clock in the day, and you wait till the, you know, the sun recedes. You can go between 9 and 4, then nothing happens. You stay at home and with air conditioning. But we didn't have air conditioning in those days. We had a thick, you know, of bamboo and leaves on it, and then the breeze came through that, it would cool it down. And it wasn't a primitive house, it was an army house. My dad was a military officer, but no air conditioning, so it was like that.
Well, that's such a privilege nowadays. You know, I think with my children, if you take them anywhere where it's warm, there's just an expectation there's air conditioning. It's just expected. Which, in fact, reminds me of the first time I went to Punjab, because the first time it was around the late 80s, and I even remember rolling blackouts. So even electricity in that period then wasn't constant.
No, that's throughout India. Even in Bombay or Calcutta, you get blackouts and the television stops. And people get extremely frustrated because the television has stopped. They don't mind the darkness.
There were so many avenues from which I can start today's conversation with you, and with so many experiences. And I think for me, I think the logical step here is to let's say wind the clock back to early 60s and yourself in Cambridge. And I understood that you studied quantum physics, which feels unusual for where you are now.
I studied natural sciences, as they call it in Cambridge. And what you do is you do part one and part two. There are three, that's why it's called the tripos, the 3 feet, Cambridge examinations. During the 3 years, you do part one, part two. And if you do English, for instance, you do prelims, then part one. And at the third year, you do part two. But in natural sciences, they count part one as a degree. So in your second year, you get your degree. You have to use the rest of the year, the last year, you have to eat your lunches or your dinners, sorry, in college. If you eat your dinners in college, then you can qualify as a BA, and then you move on to an MA honors. That's how it goes. But you can study something if you want in your last year. So I'd done natural sciences. And in the second year, I switched to advanced physics, they called it. And it was mainly, you know, quantum and this and that. So when I finished my degree, I got a letter from the Atomic Energy Commission of India saying, congratulations, will you come and join the Atomic Energy Commission? Now, at the time, Indira Gandhi was making an atomic bomb. They were working on that. And I was a peacenik and a communist and whatnot. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to do that, right? I'm not going to. So I told them, I told them no in some rude terms, saying I don't want to make your bomb or help make your bomb. And that turned me away from looking for a job in physics. In my third year, I did English.
What was your motivation for studying physics?
It was the only way I could get a scholarship. And that's what I had done in India, right? My BSc from Pune University was in sciences, and physics was my main subject. And I liked physics. Scientific exploration is the way forward for humanity. And I really do see, I'm not religious or superstitious in any way, right? I absolutely believe in rationality and science and so forth. And it comes from, I don't know where it comes from, I think it comes from a revolt in childhood against the superstition, which accounted for the poverty that I saw all around me. You know, I saw a lot of foolishness, you know, people lacerating themselves for religion, people believing, including my own family, believing all sorts of nonsense. And when you see the kind of poverty that I grew up looking around, that was, it convinced me that there was a connection between irrationality, superstition, even religion, and that degradation of humanity.
And I think that's something that is, I don't know, it feels like that's a fairly common theme from people coming from the Indian subcontinent, because Indian cultures, the variety of Indian cultures, are steeped deep in religion and in superstition. And like you say, they're on polar opposite sides of the spectrum. Those ideals both clash.
Yeah, I think some of it is very beautiful. You know, some of it is very alluring. And I wouldn't go around, you know, opposing and that. But for myself, I want to be scientific, rational, and so on. And some of it is quite disgusting when you look around India. It's not there anymore. But the poverty was absolutely crushing. You see people hungry on the streets. You'd see people starving, and not in the villages, in the bloody towns. And 3-4 urchins would follow my cook back from the market. And I'd ask the cook, what the hell are these guys doing, you know? Why are they following you? Said, well, they saw me buying bhindi, right? They saw me buying okra. And what they want is when I chop the bhindi, the tops and tails, to eat those. I said, that made me sick, you know? Mm-hmm. And I said, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to chop large pieces of topping tail to give to them. Yes. The family doesn't need it as much as they do. That was sweet.
The superstition, though, is, you know, growing up in a Punjabi family, superstition is something that was always enshrined in us. And even today, those some of those superstitious beliefs, which clash with some of the religious ideologies, they end up being instilled in you as you still have this fear that's based around them. And we spoke before, we had a beautiful conversation when we spoke a few weeks ago. And I was sharing some examples of some of the, and we look at them now and you say them out loud, they sound rather silly, but things like when you're leaving the house, if you sneeze when you're leaving the house, you have to come back inside, drink some water before you go out. And you should never call anybody back. So if somebody's leaving and you call them back, whatever that thing is that they were going to do is not going to happen because you've jinxed it.
Yeah. My grandmother used to say that if you mention the word tea, you have to drink some before you leave the house.
Absolutely. But the interesting thing is, Farooq, is you, as you raise your children and grandchildren, they start questioning some of these behaviors because they're more instilled in science than I would say that my parents' generation were then. But it's an interesting lens when you start comparing those ideologies that really, they, I guess they clash with each other.
Yeah, I was brought up religious, you know, into the Zoroastrian religion, but I haven't done that to my children at all. Mm. And sometimes now that they're in their 30s and so on, they ask me, why not? And I said, well, I didn't believe it. And I think you should make up your own mind. If you want to be religious, you can be whatever you want, you know. But I like Parsi customs and Parsi food. And I can cook Parsi biscuits and Parsi custard and so forth. And growing up in that, I don't believe any of it. But I like to read about it. Mm. I like to read about the Zoroastrian empires and so on and so forth. I've done some not research, just general reading in that field. Yeah.
So I guess more of a, I guess it's embracing the culture around the religion as opposed to the religion itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even so, I mean, I read Hinduism. Mm. I told you I read Sikhism because I was asked to do the commentary for the museum at Anandpur Sahib in Punjab. And my friend Bobby Bedi, right, Sandeep Singh Bedi, he was commissioned to do the videos and so forth for the videos, light shows for inside the museum. And he said, will you write the commentary? So I got hold of 5 or 10 books. Kushwant Singh's book is good on Sikhism, the history of. Yeah. And so I could at the time recite the names of the gurus, you know, from the first to Gobind Singh. And it was interesting how Sikhism turned from being a Sufi religion, really. Mm. You know, Nanak was a follower of Hindu, follower of Sufism. And then, of course, it turned into something militant because of persecution. And it's all very interesting. And, you know, Islam in India also is very interesting because it's absolutely full of Hindu infiltration. Because the people who turned up there to convert people, right, to Islam were mostly Auliyas and Chishtis. And they were all Sufi saint people, you know.
Well, the Sufi influences in Sikhism has always been something that's always attracted me back and always kept me connected from music to the poetry. I think It's one of the most significant parts, I think, or influences that I think many young people today still connect with.
Absolutely. I mean, I really don't understand Wahhabism and, you know, that kind of interpretation of Islam. It's nonsensical. Mm. And, you know, being anti-music, when you listen to Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, he's very religious, right? But that's Sufi music. And they believe in devotion through music. And so did Rumi, you know.
So just cycling back to Cambridge. So you studied physics.
I studied physics. I got my degree. And in my third year, I said, I want to do English. And they said, well, you can't do English. You both know this, that, and the other. And I said, well, I'd catch up. And they said, okay, very special dispensation. You can do part two English with some exemptions, right? Like you won't have to do French translation paper. You won't have to do the Anglo-Saxon paper. Instead, you do the history of how the English language was formed. And you do a fourth term. So my last holiday is a 4 months, right? From June through to October, I spent in Cambridge catching up on all sorts of things, on Chaucer and Milton. And, and then I could move on in the last year into proper English, the proper English curriculum of part two. And that's what I did. I did natural sciences and then English, unusual, but that was my degree.
What was the atmosphere like in Cambridge? And I guess this was early 60s.
This is 64 to 67, right? And the atmosphere was strange insofar as it was mostly public school boys, a minority of grammar school boys, and a very small minority of Indians and Pakistanis, right? And they were all Indians and Pakistanis from the subcontinent. There were no people from London, Manchester, Birmingham, Bradford, not one.
So they're all international students?
They were all international students at the time. You look at the universities now, right? And they're full, not full. They have a huge quota of people like yourself who studied at university here, right? Another generation, they moved on from what their parents came here to do. So they go to universities. Oxford and Cambridge has hundreds of them. And so the atmosphere changed. And what I first noticed was I got in with my neighbors, right? And my neighbors were both public school boys. And then I noticed that there were guys who used to wear donkey jackets and so forth. And I got talking to them. And they were a small group of grammar school boys from different places, from Grimsby. And I started hanging out with them, the working class kids, right? Because I felt much more an affiliation to them rather than to the rugger buggers, as we used to call them, right?
So did it feel more as though the divide was more around class as opposed to race in those days?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And race wasn't noticeable in Cambridge. You know, yes, they knew that you were Indian or something, but they thought you were exotic. That there wasn't, you know, the feeling that you were a Paki. Whereas when I came to London, and when you move to, say, Leicester or the Midlands, you get a shock, which is what I did. You know, I suddenly began to notice that 99% of immigrants were from peasantry, from East Pakistan at the time, from Punjab, from Gujarat, right? And even they were kind of shopkeepers and that they weren't. They weren't in the professions. Then there was a smattering of professional people, and there was a whole heap of race prejudice in the towns like London. In Cambridge, there was less of it. You know, you didn't notice it.
And I guess you were probably at this inflection point in time where, like you say, Cambridge is fairly isolated. So the prospect of race never really became something that was in anybody's lens. But as soon as you stepped out of Cambridge, and I guess mass immigration at that time was also starting to increase in those cities.
Last years of 60s and early years of 70s, the discrimination was dreadful. When one got to London, you know, I had run away with a lady with my then girlfriend. We intended to get married, but she absconded from her very military household. Her father was a lieutenant general, for God's sake. And we ran away together here. And we tried to look for rooms together in London. And they would say, no, sorry, no Indians here. You know, we don't want your sort here, fuck off. So, and some would say, some landlords would say, look, I don't mind, but the rest of the household won't have you. Because all we could afford was a bedsitter. Mm-hmm. You know, you could go for larger quantities. And then you'd go to pubs and they wouldn't serve you. They looked through you as though you were a ghost. You'd stand at the bar for half an hour, banging the bar and saying, come on, come and give me a pint, you know, and they wouldn't budge. And then you'd smash a bottle or something and walk out. And football crowds, I don't know why, but they'd, if they saw you on an escalator or something, they'd grab you and rough you up and beaten up a few times. It was nasty. And that's what pushed one. That's what pushed one into politics.
So around that time, I guess you were leaving Cambridge, experiencing real rural racism for the first time. And how did that then start to shape your gateway into writing?
The gateway into writing came quite unusually. I always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. I used to write for the Cambridge magazines. I had started writing articles for the Indian newspapers, right? And they published them and they paid me for them. And I wanted to write fiction. So I started to write fiction in the early days. Nothing came of it. I wrote lots of short stories. I wrote one novel. And the novel was kind of imitative insofar as I had read Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet. And I thought if he can write about Alexandria, I can write about Bombay. So I began to write that kind of large novel. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened with it. I sent some short stories through, in the Cambridge days, through a friend of mine who had a publisher, an agent. So I sent my stories to Lawrence Pollinger. And I thought, fantastic, yeah? That agent was D.H. Lawrence's agent. And I thought, oh, God, if they take me on. They sent the stories back saying, never darken our doors again, right? It's all rubbish. We don't want to publish this. So it gave me some setback. Then writing articles, I met a guy in a pub through a poet friend of mine, Vignesan. His name was Vignesan. And he said, you're writing articles? Why don't you? And I showed him some because he'd asked me to bring them at the pub in South Kensington. And he said, why don't you syndicate them? And I said, what's syndicate? I don't know what that means. And he said, meet me tomorrow at Lincoln's Inn Fields, Holborn Station. And he took me to this place called Forum World Features, right? And there was a fellow there called John Tusa. He was sitting at his desk, the editor. And Vignesan introduced me. And Tusa said, have you brought your articles? I said, I brought 10 samples. And so I gave him the articles. He said, come back in a couple of hours, I'll read them. So I went off, sat in the pub with Vignesan, came back, and the guy said, we want to buy them. And I said, you want to buy the articles? Yeah. And he said, I'll pay you £25. I said, for the lot? He said, no, for each of them. And I was absolutely astounded. I had never seen £25 in the same place at the same time. You know? So over the weeks, they started paying me £25 a week for those articles. And that was when I got properly published in all manner of universal newspapers. Very much later, years, decades later, I found out that Forum World Features was a front for the CIA. Mm-hmm. They were publishing American propaganda, but they would put my articles right at the top. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that newspapers would get convinced that this is a kind of universal free speech left-wing enterprise. And I didn't look at the facts, right? I just sent my own articles off. And then Tusa became head of the World Service, BBC. And he told the newspapers, no, I never worked for the CIA. I wasn't conscious that it was a CIA agency, right? They would send me articles. I'd hired people like Farum Dhondi, for instance. And he said that to the newspapers. Yeah. But of course, it was a cover of the CIA. And then I said, so they didn't really like my articles. They just thought that it was a good cover for the right-wing rubbish they were pumping out.
Well, I think there's a certain irony in you writing for a right-wing agency news publication to how you moved into fiction. Tell me more about how that unfolded, Farooq.
So I got into fiction, which is quite interesting. I joined the Black Panther movement in London, right? I had been in the Indian Workers Association in Leicester. I joined these Punjabi workers would come to the pub on a Friday. Yeah. And Mala and I could only afford half a pint a week, right? Because the rest went in food and rent and whatnot. So we used to go on Fridays to the pub when she got paid. And all these Punjabi workers would turn up on Friday because it was payday, right? And there'd be 40 of them sitting there, factory workers mostly. And second time we went in, Mr. Sain Chowdhury came up to us and said, "Are you Indians?" I said, "Well, obviously she's wearing a shalwar kameez. And so come and join us, come and join us." So we went and sat there with, and soon there were six pints spread out before each of us. We said, "Can't drink six pints." "No, no, no, have it. Have your beer, you know. You like beer, have the beer. You want whiskey, we get whiskey." "No, no, no, just on the second or third Friday," every Friday we'd meet there. They knew the landlord. The landlord would shut the door at 10:30, which was closing time, and pretend that they were all his guests, right? And no money would change hands. He'd just keep a tag on what it was. And then on Saturday or Sunday, somebody would come and give him his £50 or whatever it was, right? And that was pseudo-legal, if you like. Mm-hmm. Said, "These are my friends. They are my guests, right? They're not customers, because I'm not charging money." Anyway, so on one day, they looked depressed, the workers. And we said, "What's wrong? You're not the usual selves." Said, "These five have got kicked out for assaulting a supervisor." Said, "Why did you assault a supervisor?" He said, "Because he was very bad-mouthed to a lady worker, you know, a Punjaban there. Oh, how dare he?" And we got the arguments with him, and I slapped the supervisor, and so we thrown out, five of us. Okay. Said, "How many workers are there?" Said, "So many." "And what percentage are Asian?" Said, 90%. "Yeah, the rest are supervisors," and so forth. Said, "Well, why don't you strike?" They said, "How do you do that?" Said, "Well, you print out your case." Said, how you do that?" So he said, "Let's go to my universities. Union," right? So about 9:30, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, we went to the union, kept it open, renewed off, you know, printed off leaflets saying the management has been unfair, these are unfair dismissals. And by 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, we were all there standing outside the gates of the factory and handing out these leaflets. No Asian workers went in. And there were speeches and that. About 11 o'clock in the morning, the management came out and said, "We are willing to talk," right? So three of the representatives went in, including Mala. And they came back and said, "Not only are the five reinstated, the supervisor who was rude has been made to apologize, and everybody gets a 2% pay rise." Because he couldn't afford to lose even a day's production, you know.
You and Mala must have come out of that looking like heroes.
Yeah, and immediately Mala and I were made honorary secretaries of the wretched Indian Workers Association. Nobody voted for us. They just said, "You are now honorary secretaries." In that role, we did lots of things. We desegregated pubs, right? Should I tell you that story?
Yeah, absolutely.
There was a pub on the fringes of Leicester which used to front National Front meetings, the hall above, right? It was brought to our attention by students, graduate students, who were friends of mine. They said they had National Front meets there. And it wasn't an Asian pub at all, right? Even though it was quite close to where the Asians stayed in Narborough Road. And we said, "Okay, we'll desegregate the pub." And the students said, "What we'll do is we whiteys will go upstairs and pretend to be National Front recruits and listen to their lecture, right? And then at some point we'll interrupt the lecture, call them racists and fascists, and, you know, and some of you stay downstairs So five of us decided that we'd go, pretend to be customers of the pub, and sit there. The word got out to the entire Indian Workers Association in Leicester. And so five of us came and sat there. Soon, 20 more Indian workers turned up pretending to just be customers. The landlord didn't know what the hell was going on. You know, they were occupying all the tables. And the meeting started upstairs. And the students got up and interrupted. And, of course, the National Front fought them back. But as soon as there was, we heard the fighting, they all rushed up the stairs. And, of course, there were 20 National Fronters and about 100 Asians. And they beat the shit out of these poor bastards. They threw chairs and benches and a big fight. Police were called, of course. The National Front were escorted by the police because of their danger. Mm. And we continued downstairs. And the pub owner said, look, I'm not National Front. I'm just a guy who sells beer. And if you want to drink beer, drink as much as you want and pay me for it, you know. So we sat there that, and it became an Asian pub from that day on. We did several things like that, you know. A movie called The Green Berets came along. Hmm. Lots of these guys were, you know, Punjabis, had affiliations to the Communist Party in India. And they said, we don't want all this American hegemony. Hamara naam, tumara naam, Vietnam, Vietnam, you know. So we went in, pretended to be customers of the cinema house, and then disrupted the viewing. And police were called, of course, and then they said, okay, we won't have this movie. They got rid of the Green Berets movie, which is John Wayne pretending to be, you know, a great hero. And so we stopped the movie happening. Lots of little things like that, you know. Then I came down to London, finished my degree, and there was a big conference at Alexandra Palace. And we went to the conference. It had all sorts of groups there. And some of the groups were the Birmingham Indian Workers Association was fantasist Maoists, right? Mm. And their Maoism was kind of, it was fantasy, you know, because they thought we'll march from the mountains down to the cities. And there weren't no mountains to march from. They lived in dirty slums in Birmingham, you know. So rubbish. And so I thought these people are just talking tosh. But the Black Panther movement was represented by a girl called Althea Jones, right? She spoke very brilliantly about immigrants and this and that. And that's the group I'd like to hear from. So I went up to their group and noticed that there were three or four Asians amongst them. And I said, are Asians allowed to join you? They said, well, why not, you know? There was Sunit Chopra, Vivan Sundaram, and people like that, you know. They were part of the movement. So I said, can I join? They said, well, you serve an apprenticeship. So I served the apprenticeship by reporting on the Mangrove trial for the newspaper called Freedom News. And we wrote all that stuff. Every week, Freedom News would come out and we'd post it here and there. And I became a regular member of the Black Panther movement. And one day, they had invited C.L.R. James, philosopher, Marxist, revolutionary Trinidadian, old guy, you know, nearing his 80s. And he came and sat there with his big hat. He used to wear a hat. And he said, crowded room, 200 people. And he said, who writes this paper? So we said, we do. He said, why do you write all this stuff? So he said, like what? You know, these interpretations of Lenin and, you know, Marxism, that. He said, don't write any of that. We said, why? He said, write what you do to attract the population to your movement. And he said, like how? And he pointed to some guy and said, what are you doing? He said, I'm a bus conductor. So he said, where do you work? He said, the garage. And he started talking about the thing. And he said, well, how do you interact with the public? Do they ever manifest any rudeness to you? And he said, yeah, every day they get this, that, and this, squabbles, and how do the other drivers treat you, and blah, blah, blah. And he said, those are short stories. Write that down. Write it in the newspaper. It'll get other people like yourselves attracted. He turned to three or four people. Some was a nurse, some was unemployed. Turned to me, said, what do you do? I said, I'm a school teacher. He said, write down what happens in the school. I said, it's a multicultural school, right? Multiracial school. He said, write down what happens. Did. I started every week, used to write 500 words of what went on in the school, right? As short stories, you know, the fifth form disco was interrupted by black boys from Brixton, and there was a fight over a girl and who she loved and who she didn't love and so on and so forth. And I wrote this down, no signing my name. One day at school, right? And that's the crucial point. One day at school, a fellow turned up in a gray suit, young man, and said, where's Mr. Dhondi? And the kid said, the staff room at the end of school. And he came up, and my colleague said, somebody wants to speak to you. So I went to the door and said, yes. And he said, are you Farooq Dhondi? And I said, does he owe you money? And he said, no, no, no. I said, are you from the police? He said, no. No, no, I'm from Macmillan's Publishing. I said, what do you want? I thought it might be a parent or something, you know, complaining about something I've done to some people or something. And he said, I want to talk to you about your short stories. I said, what short stories? He said, the stuff you publish in Freedom News. I said, it's anonymous. How do you know? He said, the guy who sends me the newspaper at the tube station every day, every week, I buy it and I've read it. And he said, it must be, who writes this? He said, this Farooq. And so...
So your anonymity wasn't that well protected?
No. And he couldn't know. He said, I looked in the Inner London Education Authority. There couldn't be very many Farooqs, right? So I've tracked you down. I said, what do you want? He said, I want to publish your short stories. I said, those short stories, they're not really short stories. They're incidents in school, right? They're 500 words long. And you were looking at the Hemingway of India, yeah? And he said, what? I said, I'll write you some other stories, right? Because you want to publish them. He said, yeah. And then he said something very significant. He said, the audience, we've gauged as an editor at Macmillan's, that the audience for multicultural writing exists, but multicultural writing doesn't exist. I said, fine, I'll write you real short stories. And he said, like when? I said, as soon as possible. Yeah. And he pulled out a contract from his suitcase, from his briefcase. And he said, sign here. And here's £200. And I was absolutely astounded. Just came my way. Yeah. And so I spent the next month, maybe, writing short stories.
Were you still working in the school at that time as well?
Yeah.
What were you teaching?
English. Mm-hmm. And sometimes physics. Yeah. When the physics teachers, the science department, what happened was for 2 months, 3 months, they couldn't find a physics teacher. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, to my headmaster, I've got a physics degree also. So he said, you what? So I said, somebody else can do my bits of my English timetable. I'll take over the physics. And that was great fun. I did that. And East End at Your Feet, my first book, was then published by Macmillan's. And it got a bit notorious because it had a couple of dirty words in it, right? Which was, it was a quote from Mick Jagger. She's a star fucker, star fucker, star fucker, star. And so some people objected. National Front people actually objected at a school. And my editor phoned me up and said, there's a demonstration against your book outside the school in London. I said, fame at last, you know. Shall I? No, no, don't turn up there, right? And I said, great. Why don't they buy two million of the books and burn them, you know, as long as they pay for them? And he said, don't be silly, right? And of course, the protest was carried in the Daily Telegraph. This idiot, William Deeds, who was the editor, wrote an editorial saying, our children must not be exposed to this kind of
filth.
Yeah. And so the television called me to debate with him in the studio. And he was patronizing like hell to me. He said, but dear boy, it's all a question of balance. You know, balance. I didn't know what he meant by balance. He meant balance. But that's how he pronounced it. And
so this was on BBC TV or BBC Radio?
TV. I think it was ITV TV. Mm. It wasn't BBC. It was some studio and a famous host. And I did that. So that was it. They asked for my second book. So I wrote a second book called The Siege of Babylon, which was based on my experience with a chap called Wesley Dick, who held up the Spaghetti House siege, right? They went to some three of them with guns and held the people hostage for 9 days. And so I wrote about that. And then they said, we want a third book. So I wrote a third book and so on. And then a friend of mine, another writer, because from East End at Your Feet and Siege of Babylon, I was invited to lots of schools to speak and read books. And it was after the third book that I quit teaching. I thought I'd be a full-time writer. So I started writing. I was published 3 books with respectable publishers, you know, HarperCollins, the Macmillans. And then people started demanding the books, Golanx, Random House. And so it went, never gave it up. Stuck with the politics, stuck with the Black Panther movement, stuck with Race Today after that, after the Black Panther movement, another active publication of a Black activist group. And, well, ended up with about 29, 30 books.
So did the... You were still teaching when you first started writing.
Yes.
And were you, during the Mangrove Nine trial, were you teaching then?
I was teaching then, mm-hmm. but at 3:30, I would dash off to the Old Bailey, mm-hmm. right? Park the car, or post office van I used to drive at the time. Old green, rusty old post office van, which I had bought for £12. And dash up the stairs. And there'd be 3 people there who would tell me all the day's reportage. They were unemployed kids, and they would tell me what has happened in the trial, who said what, and so forth. And so we'd go back to the headquarters. By night, we'd have written it all up and posted it off to people. That was the Mangrove trial reportage.
The Mangrove Nine trial, this is how we ended up connecting, Farouk, because I watched it on, it was the first episode on Small Axe. And I know that I think Steve McQueen had been developing the series way back to 2010. When did you start consulting on the development of Small Axe?
What happened was there was a previous series called Guerrillas, right? Done by John Ridley. Now, John Ridley had, with Steve McQueen, won the Oscar for 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. John had been writing that. John had written that story, and Steve McQueen had directed it, right? At which point, John came to Britain, later on, and he wanted to speak to me about Black activism, about Race Today and the Black Panther movement and so on. He wanted to base a story on that. So he called me as a consultant. So I was, throughout the Guerrilla series, I was consulting. Yeah, they paid me for it. And they deviated completely from what the actual story was because he wanted to please the American public because it was Sky Atlantic had commissioned it. So they had all sorts of elements of a Canadian girl, which it wouldn't have been, and so on. They did that story. And then Steve McQueen started his series, but he'd fought with John Ridley. They were bitter enemies by the time these things happened. I don't know why. But he called me to speak. But after a day, right, in Holborn, with 5 or 6 researchers and writers sitting around, I told them the story of Althea Jones recruiting me. And so they had Althea talking to a group of Punjabis there.
Well, so the interesting thing about Small Axe was that it provided people in the UK with this lens on civil rights in the UK, because they think there's an Americanization of civil rights in general, that I think a lot of the things that happened in the UK, the people that were active in the UK, aren't stories that are told that often. And I think that's what one of the appeals was with Small Axe. And I think, ironically, it was filmed and produced before the Black Lives Matter movement and all of the momentum that's been gained throughout this year. So I think it was quite timely. But with one of the things that really stood out for me, Farouk, from watching that first episode, was Black people and Indian people working together.
Yeah. We were... it was like that. Black was a political color at the time. And that's what he said, yeah, openly. And I would address, as a Black Panther member, I was called on because, you know, I could speak probably more fluently than most of them. And they called me as one of their speakers. And I'd address whole groups of West Indians, right? And they wouldn't bat an eyelid, yeah? Because basically the leadership, you know, Althea and later on Darkus Howe, were from Trinidad. And 51% of Trinidad is Asian. 49% is Afro-Caribbean. And they divide there. But then the progressives amongst them say that there should be no division. They should be, you know, the activists want the population to be one, to be Trinidadian and not Asian Trinidadian and Black Trinidadian. Yeah. So they had that mentality. And that's gone, I think. It's gone from most groups now.
That cohesion of minorities working together, and you're right, I think, absolutely, I think it's just not there. But what do you think contributed to that deterioration?
The deterioration? Certain amount of nationalism, right? Mm. And ironically, a certain amount of progress, because people saw success through those radical movements, right? They went their own ways. Mm.
And I think through access to education, through development, there's been less of a demand or a need for support through movements like that. But I think when we look at it through the lens of two different communities working together, I think there hasn't necessarily been an equality,
yes,
in the standards of education. I think one group has been largely disenfranchised by an education system that didn't support them that well.
Yes.
And I think we see that as one of the factors too. One of the areas that I wanted to explore with you also was to understand if you frequented the mangrove.
I occasionally went to the mangrove, right? I wasn't a regular, but I occasionally went to the mangrove, went to the basement. There were all sorts of things going on there.
What was the energy before the trial and before everything kind of erupted from a kind of fallout from that? What was the energy around
that? The mangrove? A lot of the West Indian community off West London would gather there, right? Would gather there, they'd hang out. And they, as the Trinidadians call it, they were liming, which means sitting around. They wouldn't even eat their meals. They'd just sit there. The license came and went. There was a fight over the license because the police would object and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But there was always special brew cans and whiskey poured into the special brew and people drinking it and walking out with the police came, you know, so that I'm drinking on the pavement, not in the restaurant, and all that. So it was a very West Indian atmosphere. And on occasion, they'd start singing, and, you know, some guy would sing calypso and whatnot. it wasn't Jamaican. It wasn't reggae. It was calypso and Trinidadian, you know, the atmosphere, very much.
There's individuals over time, Darkus Howe, V.S. Naipaul, all from a Trinidadian background. And being around the mangrove at that time, being involved in the trial, getting connected with more of the Trinidadian community, tell me more about how that unfolded? How did you connect with that community?
It was completely coincidental, right? I had no, I didn't know where Trinidad was. Like, I knew it was in the West Indies, but I didn't quite know where to place it. And I looked up the map, of course. And I met Darkus only, I met him properly. I befriended him after the mangrove trial. Yeah, I didn't know him before that. And I met C.L.R. James through Darkus, right? And through the, I mean, he addressed, I'd gone to his lectures and so on, but he came to live in my house only through Darkus. And then I got to know him extremely well. And V.S. Naipaul, of course, I had followed his work all the time and so on. And I never got to know him. I shared a platform with him once. I think it was at Warwick University. Yeah. And I spoke, he spoke about something or the other. I can't even quite remember what it was. But then he turned to a friend of mine, Mehmood Jamal, and said, that rascal friend of yours, that Dhundi, he doesn't believe in anything, does he? And Jamal reported that to me. And then I was asked by, when I was at Channel 4, I was asked by the BBC to review his latest book, India, A Million Mutinies Now. So I read it, yeah. And I said, okay, I'll do that, you know, face-to-face with him. And seven in the morning, I got a phone call. Right? The phone was by my bed. I picked it up. Hello, who's that? I said, is that Mr. Dhundi? Yeah, yeah. This is Vidya Naipaul, V.S. Naipaul. I said, yeah. He said, I believe we have to speak on the television. I said, yes, we are. So what are you going to, what should we talk about? I said, well, specifically, they want me to talk about your latest book, right, which I've read with great interest. And he said, what did you think of it? And I said, well, you seem to have progressed from the earlier books about India. And he said, oh, dear, you're already giving me marks. Yeah. And I said, no, I'm just telling you what specifically I thought of it. And he said, what else? And I said, well, we might have to go through for the public interest or the criticisms that your books have faced. And, you know, I'd like you to answer them and so on. And yeah. He said, right. He put the phone down. I went back to the office, Channel 4, and the producer rang me up and said, what have you been saying to V.S. Naipaul? So I said, nothing. He rang me up this morning and said, well, he doesn't want to do the interview. And I said, why not? Because he said, you told him Negroes don't like your books. I said, that's not the kind of language I use. I never said Negroes don't like your books. Yeah. And so he's cut out. He said, no. I said, okay, that's the end of it. He said, no, that's not the end of it. We are going to use that book review slot for you to say whatever the hell you like about him alone, without him, right? And I'm going to tell his agent that. So the producer phoned Gillan Aitken, the agent, and said, we're going to give, if V.S. has backed out, we're going to give Farooq the entire half hour to say what he wants about the books. Promptly came, the phone came back. No, he will be interviewed.
So that fear that they were going to give you a platform to say anything you wanted.
Anything.
And then he turned up.
And I was very respectful. I went with two or three of his first edition books for him to sign on the desk. And he was very haughty in his interview. It was at Brown's Hotel in South Kensington. And he came walking and he answered the questions, right? But quite peremptorily. And then I said, will you sign these books? He said, I'll sign one. And he signed the one and he walked off. Right? He didn't want to interact with me at all. And then one day at Channel 4, I was heading to New York for some work. And the on the say it was Thursday or something. And on the Monday, Gilad Aitken, his agent, called me and said, Vidya Naipaul wants to have lunch with you. I said, what? Vidya Naipaul hates my guts. Why would he want to have lunch with me? So he said, no, all that has changed. You know that he married Nadira. And I said, yes, I read that in the papers. But so what? He said, well, Nadira's a great fan of yours. She's read all your books, and she reads your regular column, right? And she's dying to meet you. And so he's agreed to come to lunch at Bibendum on Thursday. I said, well, Thursday evening, I'm off to Jamaica. And he said, fine, it's just lunchtime. You can go from there. So I took my suitcase and stuff and said, looking forward to it, seeing what this was about. She came, the agent came, Vidya, very staid, wouldn't move. Yeah, just stayed dumb. And so she said, so what are you going to Jamaica for? So I said, well, we've just put in the finishing touches to this series. And she said, what's the series? So I began to describe it. I said, it's called Jamaica ER, Emergency Room, which is the accident and emergency of the hospital. And she said, oh, I said, it's already shot, right? And I tell you, it's quite a strange place. So I said, I was there with the crew, and we were entering the hospital to follow these doctors, right? And as we entered the hospital, there was a tall black guy sitting at the door, security guard. And he said, hold on. UD television people? So we said, yeah, we are, obviously. He said, well, you have to film me. So I said, film you? And I am the Nat King Cole of Jamaica. So the cameraman all looked at me, right? I was the commissioning editor. So I said, well, yeah, film him.
So at that moment, we have the Ernest Hemingway of India.
He began
the
Nat to sing.
King Cole of Jamaica.
Mona Lisa, do you not know where it was? Right? And we filmed him. It's quite good voice. And as we were filming, and he was singing, the bloody gunshots rang out just beyond the wall. Dow. Yeah. And we all kind of ducked for cover, what the fuck, you know. And he said, never mind them boys, and carried on, Mona Lisa.
nothing was going to disrupt his audience.
His audience, absolutely. He said, never mind them boys. But he was probably used to that. And of course, as we went through, trying to get shelter inside the hospital walls, there came running down two guys holding a fellow who'd been shot, bleeding like hell. And we, of course, we filmed all that. And he got dragged into the hospital for, you know, take the bullets out of his body and so on. He was still alive. They all came rushing through. The guard couldn't do anything. They all came through. And I said, we're going to start the entire series with that episode, right? Because it happened naturally.
Well, did it make the cut? Did the guy singing make the final cut?
Yeah. The whole thing. And Vidya started laughing his head off, right?
Yeah.
And from then on, it all changed. We became friends. And he called me to his house in Wiltshire. And then I've been 1,000 times there, so...
And Vidya's got a reputation for a complicated personality. And at times, highly unpredictable. But so I guess your relationship with Vidya developed. And I believe he connected with you, or he reached out to you at the time when he won the Nobel Literature Award.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I was in Bangalore at the time, and I was working at an animation studio, which was a very interesting job. And the phone rang, and my mobile phone, and they said, is that Mr. Dhondi? He said, yes. He said, this is the BBC World at One. So I said, yes. He said, do you have a landline? I said, yes, there is a landline. Why? He said, we want to speak to you at 1 o'clock our time, right? We want to speak to you live. I said, what about this and about your friend? He has an eye, Paul. So I said, fuck, he's dead. Or what?
So they thought you wanted to do an obituary.
Yes. And they said, he's just won the Nobel Prize. I said, no. Fantastic. Yay. Yeah. And then they said, give us your landline. And of course, I put the phone down and immediately phoned Wiltshire. Nadira picked up the phone and said, hi, Farooq, where are you? And I said, you know where I am. I'm in Bangalore. And she said, yes, but he's missing you. And I said, what's happening? It's fantastic. And she said, the place is flooded out with international television crews and radio crews, and people wanting interviews with him. And you know, all the newspapers are here and the whole village is disrupted by their vans and this and that. And I said, okay, I won't disturb you. No. If he hears you on the phone, he'll be extremely angry if I don't put you in touch. I said, what's he doing? He said, he's being interviewed on television, but he'll stop, to speak to you since you're calling from Bangalore. So he came on the phone and said, hello, Farooq, you've heard of my little piece of good luck. That was him.
And what, if any, how did Vidya and his work have any influence on yourself? Because personality-wise, when I... getting to know you now as part of this conversation and some of the stuff that I've kind of read up on, your personalities are opposite sides of the spectrum. And sometimes there is that old saying that gets overused sometimes, they think about opposites attracting. But what were the elements that drove both of you together as friends?
Well, the first thing was that I noticed from the very early on, when I was 16 years old, when his first books came out, and I read An Area of Darkness, and even though everybody around me, professors, college friends, I was just about to leave for Cambridge when the book came out, and everybody attacked. They said it's doing dirt on India, this, that, and the other. But when I read it, I thought, this guy is the one guy who is telling the fucking truth, right? Indians do. They have a hypocrisy in their heads, because he described a scene in which he went to a scientist's place, right? One of the chief leading scientists of India, and there were priests in the house, and they were doing horoscopes. And he said, what are you doing with horoscopes, you old scientist? He said, I'm getting my daughter married, so the horoscope has to be read. And so he said, Indians have this kind of divide their head. Right? One part of them believes this, one part of them believes that. And I thought, this is quite right. So I didn't, vocally attack anybody there. But I thought, these people are attacking this fellow for nothing. I think this fellow, Nepal, is quite straightforward. And the other thing was that I read his essays in Encounter, in a magazine. And I read these books, two, three books, as soon as they came out. And I thought, not only is this sort of a clear writer, but he's got an Indian name, right? Normally one would read Robert Louis Stevenson and Earl Stanley Gardner, for God's sake, or D.H. Lawrence. But to have a name like Vidyadhar Naipaul, I wondered, what the fuck, if he can do it, so can I. It was inspirational, because there were few writers in English. R.K. Narayan was there. Yeah. There were few writers in English at the time.
And I guess also, coming out of the collapse of the empire, a lot of people, shifted towards nationalism, even with their writing. But people like Vidya, C.L.R. James, they didn't. So was that part of the attraction?
They had no nationalism about them. They had no nationalism about them, because you can't be nationalistic about Trinidad, is what they said. And also, V.S. embraced the idea of universal culture. And he said that there is a universal culture. There is an idea. One thing is better than another. One piece of conduct is better than another piece of conduct. Things are not just relative and subjective. There is an objective truth. Mm. There is an objective way of looking at books and poems. I believed all that, right? We differed on everything, right? We really did differ on everything. I mean, he was a conservative. He would say, I vote for Thatcher. So you vote for Thatcher. He said, I wish she was dead. And he'd say, don't say that, Farouk. You know, and all that sort of stuff.
From what I understand, your relationship with Video was very close. You even bought him Augustus the Cat. And it's funny because as I was doing some research before this conversation, I came across an article of a reporter that had gone to Vidya's house to interview him, but it was just after the death of Augustus. And that's what he ends up writing about, because it was difficult to have an interview or conversation with Vidya because he was still mourning the passing of Augustus. But tell me more about how you were involved in acquiring Augustus for Vidya.
I went with Nadira, so Battersea Dog and Cat Center, and we chose, he thought he needs a pet. We chose this little kitten that she, Nadira, chose. And they said, well, we can't release it now. It has to have injections to be taken out of here and kept in quarantine for a week. And then you got to assure us that it's not leaving town, right? You don't take cats out of London. I said, okay. I gave my address as where I was taking the cat, right? And I went in a week's time, signed the papers, paid for the injections and so on, put it in the cage, put it on my convertible Saab. It was summertime, and we drove down August, because it was his birthday. And we went and gave the cat to him as a present. At first, he was a bit diffident, you know. He said, cat, never seen, never kept. And then began to stroke it and called it Augustus, after the Emperor Augustus. And over the months, he just got absolutely, it was his baby. It was his child. And he grew very, very fond of it. Augustus, my boy. Augustus.
And in fact, Farouk, I think you have this amazing ability to draw out relationships from the most unusual of circumstances. And, you know, just spinning back to something you mentioned before around CLR James, and I understand that he was a house guest of yours, so he lived with you for a while. Tell me more about how that came about and your experiences of living with CLR James.
He came to live for a few days because he had a fight with his young wife, right? And I went and fetched him. He didn't want to stay there anymore. And he came there and Darkus said, he'll stay for a few days, please. You've got a spare room. So in my flat, he stayed in the spare room. And then when I moved from there, he came with me to Halesworth Road in Lewisham. And he stayed there and he was supposed to stay for a few weeks there, but he stayed for 6 months or so.
And I believe he was a fairly fussy house guest as well, wasn't he?
Totally. He kept asking for 3.5 minute eggs. It was 3 and 40 seconds. He'd say, this egg is overcooked. I can't eat this.
Would he throw the egg at you?
No, he wouldn't. No. But he'd wake up at 6:30 in the morning and start fooling around the house. And if you didn't want to wake up at 6:30, you know, you had to. And then he'd say, by 7 o'clock, where's my breakfast? Where's my breakfast, man? And then, you know, I'd say, look, I've got to go to the airport and in the morning. And he said, my sister and brother-in-law are coming. So he'd say, Farouk, when will you stop allowing these people to impose on you?
Oh, I love it. So the person who was imposing just didn't feel that way.
You've got to do this for me that way. I said, I can't this afternoon. I'm going to fetch my sister. I said, when will you stop these people imposing on you?
But I guess sharing, you know, there is no more intimate space than your home. And I guess sharing that for a period of time with CLR James, that must have been an incredible experience. The stories, his own experiences.
His own experiences and his talk and the stuff I saw. You know, people would come in. He moved to Race Today. He moved to above the Race Today offices. There was a flat, single room flat with a bathroom and a kitchen. And he lived there. And I used to attend to him there, see to him. He would sit in bed most of the time, watch cricket, or listen to Beethoven, to Mozart. Yeah. And I said, I prefer Beethoven. And he said, wrong. Mozart is the man.
But see, mapping the relationship back to the Black Panthers and very much the left-wing movements, I read something about C.L.R. James recently that he had an encounter with Trotsky. And did he share any of that experience with you?
Yes. I said, what was remarkable about Trotsky? He said, nothing really, except that he would alternate languages. He'd go from French to English to German to Russian to back to English, right? When talking to me, he'd chuck in German words, this, that, and the other. And he said that it was quite remarkable. He'd do it absolutely fluently as though you're coming out of the same brain, the same sentence, right? And then I said, what did you talk about? And he said, he asked me, what can the Negroes do for the revolution? And so I said, that's not the right question, Mr. Trotsky. What can the revolution do for the Negroes? And he said that that was remarkable about him. And he was a Trotskyist at the time, but because he was anti-Stalin. But then he gave that up. And he tried to interpret Marx himself and succeeded. His books on Marxism, right, and his attitudes towards Marxism are much more in line with Marx and Engels' theories than any of these socialist groups. That's why we followed him down. Race Today was a Jamesian enterprise. Yeah.
It's an interesting relationship because the Bolsheviks, they provided guidance to some of the ethnic minorities that were being persecuted in Russia at that time.
But the Stalin then persecuted the peasantry. Mm. See, Lenin wasn't, he said he was a Marxist, but you can't convert, according to Marxism, you can't convert a peasant country, 90% peasant country, into communism. It doesn't happen, or socialism. And Lenin began to realize that later and said, look, this can't be done. Yeah, something else needs to be done. We can have good government. Same with Mao Zedong. Mao Zedong is not a communist. They march down from the mountains. Look at China. The workers are controlled by the Communist Party. Okay, they have food, clothes, and shelter, but it's the worst capitalist country in the world. Yeah, because it has capital with a government that rules the workers and tells them to do it. No trade unions allowed.
So the time that C.L.R. James spent with Trotsky, do you think, apart from maybe just the academic, was there any value gained either side from the time they spent together on their respective movements?
I don't think so. I think that he came away quite disillusioned with the Trotskyist movement, which he had joined in America. And then he quit that Trotskyist movement, went back to Trinidad and fought for nationalisms there, you know. And he fought there very strongly for a federation of the West Indies. And they began talks on that. But of course, Jamaica said, we want to go it alone because of the ambitions of politicians. And then Eric Williams of Trinidad said, 1 out of 10 leaves 0. So they all split and they became small islands. CLR got fed up because there was no federation of the West Indies, which is what he wanted. And he left. He said, these places can't govern themselves. What are they going to do?
Ambitions of politicians, especially around nationalism, creates this polarization. One that, in my own opinion, is exactly what we saw with Brexit.
Yeah. I mean, Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, right, knew exactly what Brexit would bring. But they thought, let's get hold of the prejudices of the British people against foreigners, yeah, xenophobia, keep Johnny Foreigner out. That's the only policy that they wanted. They made up all sorts of things about the National Health Service will be renewed with millions of pounds, and then that the Turks will come and invade the place with their Islamization. And that's all bonds.
Well, I'm of the opinion that Brexit was an error. And as you say, the ambitions of politicians, I honestly believe that I think racial polarization is
xenophobia.
It's become weaponized as a means of politics to gain votes for agendas, for careers.
Today, I believe that latest surveys show that 60%, above 60% of people say we should rejoin the union because it's a disaster.
There'll be a reunification movement soon enough.
10 years.
And with yourself living through so many periods of seeing real racial divides, facing racism firsthand, and then seeing where the movements are pushing towards now, so nationalism, popularism, evidently we've come a long way, but do you feel as though we are taking steps backwards, or is this just the general nature of human beings?
I think that the kind of rank racism that we saw, right, has disappeared through in a large swathe of the population, right? It used to be fairly uniform in a different generation. This generation has moved on. And I really think that we are making progress, even though we go backwards with voting for Boris Johnson and voting for Brexit and this and that. It's one step back and two steps forward is how I see it. Because even Trump is gone now. And Mr. Biden may not be very hot, but he'll certainly continue some of Obama's reforms. And slowly things move forward like that. America is never going to be, not in the recent future anyway, but C.L.R. James always says that America is the country closest to communism, which is quite a very strange thing to say. But he said the democratic structures of America will finally lead to some kind of equality.
Just winding back a second to your relationship with Dacus. And when you were covering the Mangrove 9 trial, I guess you were, intimately observing Dacus and his approach to
Dacus, Barbara, Althea, Frank Crichton.
What was it about Dacus that you think propelled him to the center of the civil rights movement in the UK? What was distinctive about Dacus amongst other people?
The one thing he was is he was extremely intelligent, right? Full of insight into a situation. And then he could gauge an audience just by looking at them and beginning to speak. He would gauge what was going on and speak to them with the most sophisticated insights, right, without any resort to what he had read or cliche. He would talk about what they were concerned with. And it was a great gift. It was a great gift to address an audience exactly as they wanted to be addressed. And some of it was pure rabble-rousing, right? Some of it was pure rabble-rousing, but again, with a kind of tight harness to the rabble rousing. He wouldn't start shouting, kill the pigs, and get people to, you know. He would say, these are the police, this is what they've done, this is why they have done it, this is why they've probably done it, you know. And he'd get at that, say, after the New Cross massacre, yeah, after the New Cross fire, he would subtly label it a massacre. He'd say, they say it's a fire, somebody started it inside. You know your peril, you know, you know your sons and daughters. Would they set fire to a house with a party? So what are they talking about? You know, and of course the crowd would know what they're talking about. So he'd get that on his side. He had the benefit of the Jamesian principles, you know, and arguments. And we would have a dialectic, if you like, conversations, you know, him and me and others. We would talk about what the situations actually were in particular places, what they needed, and so on.
You first met him at Marble Arch Tube Station.
That's right. Yeah. I met him at Marble Arch Tube Station. I got into the train with a group of Asian friends, and Shahid Sayyad, Adil Jasawala, and so on. We were sitting in the train, Mala, me, and this young, handsome man came around with some newspaper he was selling. It's called the Black Eagle. And he sold us one. And my friend Shahid bought one. And he turned to me and said, do you want to buy one? I said, I'll share his. He said, will you share the same jail sentence? I just walked off. I didn't know what he meant, but the sentence remained in my head. Then I met him again at the Mangrove, at the Mangrove trial. And then slowly, as he joined the Black Panther movement, we became very firm friends.
And you and Darkus stayed connected all the way up until his death a few years ago. And I believe you were invited to provide his eulogy at his funeral.
Yep. Yes. I wrote a poem to him at the time, saying that you might have been all these things, but basically you were my friend. Yeah, that was the point of the sonnet. But I had to talk about him, as the lead voice in the church. But that's how we were. I had given him the jobs on television, editing the Bandung File first, and then as the Devil's Advocate, the program. We had a lot of adventures together. Some good, some bad, some naughty.
Oh, well, I won't ask you to share the naughty ones, but what is the what would you say is your most memorable experience with Darkus?
The most memorable experience with him? Well, the thing about him was he once said, Dondi, I sent you to Trinidad two, three times, man, and you never take me to India. So I was going to do a shoot on a film called Bandit Queen. And I said, okay, we booked 28 seats, right, from here, and we've got 27 people. So have a seat. So we went to Delhi and to Agra, and we had quite a few adventures and laughs and this and that. It was fun being with him. He would look around the place and he'd say, Dondi, who is Bajaj? So I says, Bajaj? He said, why? He said, I see him near one of your three-wheel cars. So I said, they're not three-wheel cars, they're called rickshaws, right? And yes, his name is on them because Bajaj manufactures them. He said, I don't see his name. I don't see anybody else's name on them. So I said, no, he's the only one who manufactures these rickshaws. He said, boy, you've told me more about Indira, Rajiv, and this government's economic policies than I could read in any book. monopolies of Bajaj. And the other very funny story was, I'll cut it short, we went to Fatehpur Sikri, right? And he says, Dondi, who built this? And the crew gathered around to listen, English girls and all these people who were there for makeup and this and that. And we'd gone there by coach from Delhi for a day or two. And I said, it was built by the Emperor Akbar. And he said, who was he? I said, he was a third Mughal emperor. And he was a nice guy. He tried to unite Hindus and Muslims and different religions and so on and so forth. He said, so no tragedy then? I said, oh, yes, there was a tragedy. His son, Salim, Prince Salim, later on Emperor Jahangir, fell in love with a courtesan, with a dancing girl, a prostitute. And everybody was listening intently then. And he said, I want to marry her. And Akbar, the father, said, you can't marry her. You promised to one of the cousins of the Shah of Iran, Nur Jahan is going to turn up as your wife. You can't make a prostitute the Empress of India, for God's sake. He said, no, I'm in love with her and I want to marry her. And he said, that's all nonsense. And he sent him off to the wars, hoping he'd die rather than disgrace the house. Everybody's listening to this by this time. And so I cut the story short. I said, well, he came back triumphant from the wars instead of dying there. And then Akbar said, well, what are you reconsidered? You can have her, but not as a wife, right? And he said, no, I'm going to marry her and make a respectable woman of her. She'll be Empress of India. He said, no, she not, won't, and chucked him in jail, imprisoned him for his defiance. And he called the girl, Adarkali, and he told her, listen, I'm going to pay you a pension. Go away to Afghanistan. I'll settle you in a palace in Kabul and give you a pension for life, right? You can bring up your children. They just leave my son alone. Right? And she said, no, I love him. He said, okay, I'll double the money. And she said, no, I'm not in this for money. I love him and he loves me and we're going to get married. And he said, okay, so you're defying me. She said, what's there to defy, right? And he said, okay, take her away and execute her. And they did execute her because they were building a palace in Lahore. And he built into one of the pillars of the palace, he put the woman in and they walled her up, right? And she died of suffocation inside. There was not a dry eye in the house. Everybody, oh, what a story, what a great story. Yeah. Douglas didn't say anything. Late at night, next day, we're going in the coach, right? Back in the dark to Delhi. Voice comes from the back where he was sitting. But wait, the boy come to me and say, I want to marry Dior. I say, no, you can't make her Empress of India. He says, I love her. I say, these are not matters of love. These are matters of social and political arrangement.
Spoken like a true political revolutionist. One of the areas that I wanted to touch on with you was your relationship with Mala Sen. Mala was your first wife, and I'm curious to understand what lasting impact Mala had on you.
I don't know whether she had any lasting influence on me because we were teenage lovers in college in India, and then I came to Britain and got into the mood of the 60s, you know, where it was free love and free sex and this and that. But then I kept writing to her and longing to be with her and so forth. And then in our first holidays, a friend of mine, Johnny Snow, said he was traveling to India by coach and hitching. And so I said, I'll join you. So we went overland to India, right? Except the last journey. When we landed in Iran, there was a plague in Afghanistan, so we couldn't go through Afghanistan. So, and I couldn't go through Pakistan with an Indian passport. So they would go through Pakistan overland, right? Not through Afghanistan. And I would take a plane back to Bombay from the south coast, which is what I did. Then I found Mala, and we'd made some contrivances. And when we came back to England, Mala came. I sold my motorcycle. My uncle's had given me a motorcycle in my teenage. Sold it, deposited the money. You could buy an air ticket with that, right? She had a passport because she'd contrived a kind of false marriage with Johnny Snow, and so had a British visa, British passport. Turned up. And she began to work here, right? And then through Leicester, yeah, and the Indian Workers Association thing I told you about, and through this allegiance to socialism, she began to pick up an extreme view of revolutionary activity. And she was completely overtaken by that. Her stepbrother, when their mom died, gave her £120,000, right? No, the mother left £120,000. The mother had a stepson, right? And she said, this money doesn't belong to my mom, it belongs to him. So she gave the money away. Then she had jewelry, right? He was a general's daughter. Yeah. And rich, brought up in the best schools in Dehradun. And she used to give her jewelry away to her black friends, saying, "You need it more than I do. What am I going to do with this gold or these pearls?" She says, "Hand them on." And of course, they would sell them and have a good time. So she was like that, dedicated to being socialistic. Mm. And, you know, that dedication sometimes irritated me, right? But sometimes made me admire her extremely deeply. And we were very close right to the end, even though we got divorced. And, you know, we went our ways. She would look after my children, take them swimming and so on. Yeah. Right to the end, we were close as friends, you know, even though we'd abandoned the husband-wife status, which didn't work. So
that influence, though, I think if you look at those formative years of your time in the UK, I guess there's a significance of yours and Marla's relationship.
Yeah, she picked up all this socialist stuff for me, but she took it in her own direction, right? She took it in her own direction. I tried to tell her that socialism is not Gandhianism, right? Giving away jewelry doesn't make you socialist. It makes you generous, yeah, but it's not the recommendation of Marx or Engels anyway. So there. But she was, combined with that, she said, the people, they need it. Yeah.
And during that time as well, and especially that time in the 60s, and you had some formidable experiences. And, you know, one of the things that I remember you shared with me, and it'd be good to talk around that, was the moment that you met the Beatles and the Maharishi.
Oh, yeah. That was when I was working for an agency in Germany with a photographer friend called Andrew Wittock, and he would, you know, find particular stories. We were the first people to interview, for instance, and take photographs of Pink Floyd. They hadn't made a hit then, and then they made this hit called See Emily Play by Sid Barrett, who was then in the group. He left the group later, but they made their first album, and we'd written about things, and they took phrases from my article and put them at the back of the album. Well, the designer did, not Pink Floyd. But we sort of made acquaintance with them because Andrew called them to his house in Hampstead, where he had a photographic studio. And they spent the day there being photographed in different costumes against different backgrounds. So I wouldn't say friends, but we, you know, We knew them, and later on at a concert, we went backstage, and they say, old pals, you know. And he came to me one day, phoned me, and said, the Maharishi, somebody called the Maharishi is meeting the Beatles at the Hilton. So we turned up at the Hilton, and there was a police cordon and barriers and hundreds of reporters waiting outside to get in. They weren't allowed in. Nobody was allowed in. It was going to be a private meeting. And then a limousine drove up and George Harrison stepped out. And I had long hair and a beard, and I was wearing a kurta, Indian, it was summer, and beads. And he grabbed my wrist and said, "You want to go in?" I said, "Yes." And I took hold of Andrew, and he pulled us through. The police didn't stop him, right? So with his bodyguards or whatever, they pulled him through. We were the only two in the first meeting with the Maharishi and the Beatles. And they began talking all this crap about, Maharishi, this, that, and the other, and spirit. And I was just listening to this. Andrew was taking pictures left, right. We stepped out, and all the reporters came and said, "What's your report? Sell us your report. Sell us your report." And the person who offered me the most time and space and money was The Listener, the magazine. So I wrote the article for The Listener. It must be somewhere.
You've been quite fortunate, Farouk, because I guess over time you've been at certain inflection points in history, and we've covered so many We've covered so many in this conversation, but also just to kind of, you know, wrap the conversation up today around the Beatles and the, you know, the moment that they met the Maharishi had a significant impact on, you know, on the direction of the Beatles, their own ideology as well. But being in that room at that moment where they made first contact,
yes,
there's an incredible experience.
Yes. And after John Lennon died, I was on a trip at Christmas to Jamaica, sitting in business class, right, with the crew that we were taking to Jamaica to do Black Christmas, right? We thought that's what we'd do for Channel 4. And this girl, what's her name? The television presenter. I forget her name. She said, oh, hi, Farooq. She was sitting next to me. She came and sat next to me. And then she said, I'm going down to first class because Paul McCartney and his wife has reserved the whole of the first class. And they're down there. And they've invited me. So she went down. She came back up, right, in a minute and said, come down. Paul says he'd like your company. So I think he remembered that we were the that I was the guy who'd interviewed them. I went down. They'd taken over the whole place. They'd opened up the bar, having a drink. Their children and their nanny and street porter. That's who it was.
Janet Street Porter.
Yeah, Janet Street Porter. So I went down. I knew Janet from Channel 4. So we went down and talked to Paul about the Maharishi and about John Lennon and so on. And he was very generous about everything, you know. He didn't say, I wrote that song, though. Yeah, he was very straightforward. We said he was going to a resort that he had in Jamaica. He had a private resort in Jamaica. I didn't know that. So we said, shall we meet up there? And he said, nah, difficult.
Farooq, this experience with you today on New Year's Eve of 2020 is, you know, it has been an absolute joy. And as I reflect on, we've covered so many stories, so many experiences, so many periods in time, that what I find remarkable, Farooq, and I know that you're a very humble person and you're just going to tell me that it's just luck, but I know it's more than luck, is if I reflect on all these experiences, I don't think many people could go a lifetime with living what I think you've lived several lifetimes.
My dear, you don't think about it at the time. You just get on with life, just as you're doing now. You know,
what is it about yourself when you reflect on yourself that you think any certain decisions that you've made or the attitude that you've had or the approach that you've taken, what do you think has contributed to several lifetimes of experience?
My dear, luck. It really has been fortunate of being the right time at the right place. I mean, who would have thought that, you know, writing incidents from school would bring a chap to you saying, write a book and I'll pay you to write the book. I mean, most writers, you know, peddle their work around and look for publishers and look for agents and find disappointments. And, you know, here's somebody coming to me saying, write a book, for God's sake. And I want to be a writer. So I started, and that's, and it got picked up.
So timing. So I guess the universe, the stars were just aligning at the right time.
My dear, yeah. And then, you know, having written the books, a guy comes to me and says, can we turn one of your short stories into a play? So I said, who are you? And he said, my name is Charlie Hanson, and I started the Black Theatre Cooperative, and we've done a play and this and that. And I said, no, don't do the short stories. I'll write you a special play about the using your actors from the Black Theatre Co-op. Got to know them, wrote my first proper stage play called Mama Dragon. And it opened at a community center in Paddington. But then it went to the ICA, and then it went to the Arts Theatre. Transferred it to these places. Just luck again. I began a stage career.
Do you think a lot of that luck is a manifestation of you not saying no to opportunities? Did you just embrace every opportunity as it came and just rolled with it?
Depends on what the opportunity was. You know, after the plays, right, there came the idea of a guy approached us again, ITV guy, Humphrey Barclay, and said, I've seen the Black Theatre Co-op's work. I've seen your plays. Will you write a situation comedy using the Black Theatre Co-op? I said, what for? He said, do a workshop for television. We pay you so much. I said, yeah, right, that's what we'll do. So we got the Black Theatre Co-op, did a workshop, and out of it came the long-running first black comedy for Channel 4 called No Problem, right? So No Problem was there, so I'd written that. And once I did No Problem, the commissioning editor at the time said, can you write us an Asian comedy? So again, television started as good luck. So I wrote Tandoori Nights. And having written Tandoori Nights, I was called by the BBC and said, what about your East End activist experience? Can you write us something about that? So I wrote a BBC Two series called King of the Ghetto, right? And from having done all that, Jeremy Isaacs called me to lunch and said, I want you to be commissioning editor. So just one thing followed from another. It's incredible.
A chain of events that then fused another chain of events.
Yeah. He called me to lunch at the Ivy. And I thought, what the fuck is he calling me to lunch at the Ivy for? Right? So I turned up. And he said, what are you drinking? And I said, I have a glass of red wine. And he said, he ordered a bottle of 84 pounds worth claret. I suppose he put it on expenses, but I thought, something's going on here. He can't like my writing that much. You know? So he said, well, let's get down to work. You know that Sue Woodford is leaving. I said, yeah. Talk to Sue Woodford all the time. I said, whoever comes in our place, I hope they like my work. He said, that may not be necessary. So I said, what do you mean? So he said, we want you to be the commissioning editor. So I said, me? Do an office job, like 9 to 5. And he said, nobody works from 9 to 5 at Channel 4. We come in at 12 and go at 1 in the morning. But here I am, you know, for an office salary, I'm earning a lot of money writing things for you. He said, you realize that could dry up. He was blackmailing me. So I said, okay, I'll consider the job. First thing I did was go into CLR James and said, look, I've been offered this job. You know what he did? CLR pointed to a book that he was reading and he shook his finger saying, to indicate no, no, no. Then he pointed at the television, right, and kept pointing at the television. And I understood from that he meant television was the future, do the job. So I called up Jeremy Isaac's secretary and said, send me the application form, I'm going to do it. And of course, I had the job, they promised it to me, but they interviewed 12 people or something just to keep it, you know, to find somebody better. But at the end of the interviews, 12 interviews, same day, Frank, the personnel manager, he came up to me and said, of course, you've got the job. We promised it to you. There it is. Can you come in tomorrow? I said, okay.
And I think, you know, Farouk, I think when you look at the network of friends and associates that you kept around you, Althea, Darkus, CLR James, V.S. Naipaul, Marla, the list is endless. And the list, and I'm sure there's many names that I haven't mentioned. And I think a lot of that success and luck is attributed to the people that you kept around you as well. The ones that influenced you, that advised you, that supported you.
Yeah, they all did. You know, they all did. Learned a lot from them.
And I've learned an incredible amount from this conversation today. And I'm conscious that we've been talking for a long time and we could continue for hours quite merrily, but...
Okay, we're going away, but you must keep in touch.
Absolutely. You know, for me, Farouk, just having this experience for a couple of hours, and I know we spoke in depth beforehand as well, is it had a real impact on me because...
But you're not even in London, are you?
No, I'm in Shropshire, in the Midlands.
Would you ever come to London?
Yeah, I think once the once it is safe to travel.
Yeah, let's meet up.
Absolutely. I it would be a real honor to.
Come home. I'll cook you some Punjabi food. I'll cook you some Parsi food.
Yes. Yeah, and you know what? I will take you up on that offer.
Please do.
I think that's very kind and I would really look forward to it. And I really want to keep in touch. And I think for me, Farooq, one of the reasons for doing this and having this platform is it's not just to have these conversations for the sake of recording them, but it's to make a connection, is to establish friendships. And and that is a really important output for me. And the experience that we've had today is something I'm always going to treasure, Farooq. And I look forward to meeting you when...
I enjoyed it. Enjoyed talking to you, Bobby. Right? Please keep in touch.
Absolutely will do. Thank you, Farooq. To my listeners, as always, thank you so much for giving me an audience today to share this conversation. I really appreciate the time that everybody spends in listening and also providing feedback. Now, as always, I will put a whole load of information about Farooq and links to every topic that we have discussed into today's show notes, and they're going to be extensive. There's going to be a long list of links to stories, to authors, to books, film, TV. Oh, the list is endless. Now, if you've enjoyed today's conversation, then please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts, and hit me up on my mailing list. Hit the link in the show notes, subscribe to the mailing list and get notifications of new episodes and detailed show notes directly into your inbox. I also want to give a shout out to Naina Redu, who donated the artwork for this episode. That incredible photo of Farooq was taken by Naina, and she is an immensely talented artist and photographer out of Gurgaon in India. And I will put some links to Naina's social profiles. And I strongly recommend you check out her work. There's some incredible pieces that Naina is constantly crafting. And in regards to this episode, share the love on social media. Share this conversation with your friends. Have this conversation with your friends, because when we have conversations like this, it breaks down barriers. It smashes through prejudice. And conversation is the most powerful thing we can do to help people feel understood, to ensure they have a voice, and to drive healthy and constructive debate. So, this is me signing out of an incredible, memorable, and amazing episode of the Bobby Jagdev Podcast. Thank you for listening. Till next time.